sorry, I skipped number four. Should be Lewatin versus ITA Software. Sorry about that.
May it please the Court, I'm Brian Davis, representing the appellant ITA Software. Your Honors, this is a dispute over stock options under an employment letter that was signed by ITA Software and the appellee Derek Levitin back in April of 2005. The actual employment letter appears in the supplemental appendix at beginning of page 18. A basic principle underlying that employment letter is that the total number of stock options that Mr. Levitin ultimately retained would be tied to ITA's subsequent financial performance. Okay? That concept is explicitly stated in the employment letter in two separate places. If I could direct the Court's attention to that, it appears in the bottom paragraph on the first page of the employment letter. Specifically notes that Mr. Levitin is granted up to 200,000 shares of ITA common stock or options to purchase up to 200,000 shares. However, up to 150,000 of the options will be subject to forfeiture based upon the company's achievement of certain revenue goals. And the specific formula that's used is that 10,000 options will be retained for each $10 million of ITA's gross revenues for the 12-month period from June 1, 2006 through May 31, 2007, which is defined in the agreement as the assessment period. The same concept is reflected further on the second page of the employment letter, where it notes that in the event ITA enters into a significant transaction that materially alters the company's business model or revenue outlook, parties will revisit and they will mutually determine a revised framework that links the continued vesting of options or other financial benefits in the event options are not feasible, both to your individual performance and ITA's overall performance. So it's made quite clear in the contract that the amount of options that Mr. Levitin would retain is tied not only to his individual performance, but also to the financial performance of ITA overall. The district court's decision on summary judgment, however, completely ignores that provision. It gives no effect to that basic underlying principle or to those provisions of the contract. It completely divorces Mr. Levitin's stock option compensation from ITA's overall financial performance in contravention of the clear intention of the parties. And it does so using the wrong legal standard. In determining whether the court made a determination on summary judgment that this contract, in the circumstances, was not ambiguous, it determined that that provision would be given no effect. It then went ahead and awarded summary judgment to Mr. Levitin. And in doing so, it's in determining whether the contract was ambiguous, the district court determined that the contract, the interpretation of the contract that was being offered by ITA was not equally plausible to the interpretation offered by Mr. Levitin. And on that basis, the district court determined that the contract was not ambiguous, that it should be determined as a matter of law in Mr. Levitin's favor, and that summary judgment should be awarded to Mr. Levitin. That was an error. Okay.
A question. During this time that he's employed, did the company ever tell him that some of these triggers for forfeiture had been reached and that he could not have vested stock options for any particular month?
No, Your Honor, because there was no need to, if I may explain. The way Mr. Levitin's stock options were to be determined under the formula set out in the employment letter is that he accrues stock options during a course of his first 3 years of employment. Then, that's step one. Step two is that during the course of this assessment period, at the end of this assessment period, there's a reconciliation called for where the number of stock options that he has received will then be reconciled against the revenues. And the number
I don't understand that. At the end of the three-year period?
Yeah, at the end of the assessment period.
So if he left after 13 months, he could have 13 months' worth of options, but he wouldn't know until 3 years whether he could exercise all of them?
Well, actually, the way that the agreement was established, Your Honor, is that, again, it's signed in April of 2005, and he began employment with the company around that time. The assessment period that was initially called for is from June 1, 2006 through May 31, 2007. And so what ultimately would be determined is the amount of options.
He had to work a full year before any options
Correct.
Vested.
Correct.
So that's why I used 13 months in that example.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just trying to follow the argument here. If he quit at the end of 13 months
yes.
and claimed a right to 13 times 5,000, whatever that number is, of stock options to be exercised at $10 a share, is it your position that it would have to wait until 3 years had passed from the date he started employment to reconcile whether these forfeiture events had occurred?
No. He'd have to wait until the end of the assessment period, which wouldn't necessarily occur 3 years later.
When would it occur?
It would, again, under the terms of the contract, the assessment period would end on May 31, 2007. So that would be approximately 2 years after he had started work. And so if he left after 13 months, Your Honor, for example, he would have to wait no more than a year in order to have the number of stock options that he ultimately would retain. By the way, the company's not public, so he can't really do much with the stock at that time period other than take the shares. But so there's a period of time that he would have to wait in order to compare the number of options that he had received versus the revenues of the company to determine whether he was required to forfeit some. But the agreement is quite clear that that's the one two-step process that was called for. And that's what's written out of the employment letter.
I always like it when lawyers say it's quite clear because the other side is they have a different view.
It's absolutely true, Your Honor. I have difficulty with this case, actually, because it says it. It says right on the face of the contract that his stock options will be revisited at the end of this assessment period, and that there will be a forfeiture if the revenues of the company fall below those stated thresholds. And the exact formula is spelled out. The problem that we had in this case is that the way the formula was contemplated by the parties and set forth in the agreement, the beginning of the assessment period is triggered by the completion of development of 1U, which is the software program. And if 1U is never completed, then the assessment period, the way the contract was written by the parties, is never triggered. But the contract doesn't contemplate on its face how the parties will determine the total number of options that Mr. Levitin retains in such circumstances. It has a gap. It doesn't address the circumstances that actually arose here. And even the district court found that. The district court found, in its opinion, that the way the circumstances played out was not the way the parties expected them to play out. So what we have here is I go directly to the Zielinski case, which was decided by this court in 2006. Different circumstances involving a closure agreement, but very similar in the sense that the agreement did not address, didn't provide, fill the gap. There was a question as to what drug benefits the retirees would receive going forward in that case. And the actual plan that demonstrated what drug benefits they were to receive apparently was nowhere available. So in the circumstances, there was a gap as to what benefits they would receive. And this court said that created an ambiguity on account of incompleteness, and the matter had to go back to the district court to have that gap filled by the methods of litigation. The court had to go back, consider all the evidence, determine what would be a reasonable manner of filling that gap in the circumstances. And that's exactly what we have here, is that this contract contemplates really two possibilities. One is that the 1U program would be completed according to its original schedule, or two, that it would be completed. It might be deferred for some period of time, but it still would be completed. And if that happens, then this contract can be applied according to its terms. If that doesn't happen, we have a problem. And that's exactly what occurred. If 1U was put on the shelf. And both parties agree it's on the shelf with no intention of revisiting it. It was, unfortunately, a failure. So in those circumstances, the question arises, what stock options does Mr. Levitin retain? And again, I know, Your Honor, I don't believe necessarily that it's clear, but it's certainly, reading this contract, It's a plausible interpretation of the contract. Okay, I think it can reasonably be interpreted as tying Mr. Levitin's total stock option compensation to the financial performance of ITA in a subsequent time period. And that makes sense. I mean, Mr. Levitin was being brought on board to trumpet and promote 1U. And so the way the contract was structured is that he was brought on board to work on that project. And then the parties set in the future a period of time where the results of his work would be measured. How did it impact the total revenues of the company? And the evidence in the record shows that Mr. Levitin thought that he could sell 1U to many airlines, that it would be a tremendous success in the market, and that it would generate tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue for the company. If it's a failure, okay, and if in those circumstances he would receive the stock options that had been granted to him in the first instance or that had accrued over the time of his employment, or some portion of those depending upon the ultimate revenues. It seems incongruous and contrary to the apparent intention of the parties that if 1U is a failure, that Mr. Levitin walks off with the total number of available stock options simply because this assessment period that's called for in the agreement is not triggered. And the other significant error in the court's decision, again, is that the district court used the wrong legal standard to determine whether this contract was ambiguous. The district court cited to a case that's called Episcope, Paul Episcope. It's a 2007 Illinois appellate court case. Your Honor, that case is the effective equivalent of a legal platypus. It is this odd evolutionary spur that went nowhere. If you go back to the Episcope case, you see it relies on it. There's no doubt the Episcope case says that a contract is ambiguous if the parties propose different interpretations and then one is not equally plausible. That's what Episcope holds, and that's what the district court cited it for here. If you go back and look at Episcope, you see it cites to another Illinois appellate court case, Kranz, which doesn't apply that standard. It applies the accepted standard, which is that a contract is ambiguous if it is reasonably susceptible of more than one meaning.
You're in your rebuttal.
I will save the rest of my arguments. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Mirzik.
May it please the Court, my name is Don Mazurk, and I represent the plaintiff appellee, Derek Levitin. I think what you heard from the other side in this case is an argument that disregards centuries of contract interpretation law. When you're called upon to interpret a contract, you don't look at the basic principle. You don't look at the basic underlying principle, the concept of the contract.
Did the parties contemplate the completion of the program?
Your Honor, what they did is they wrote
very simple question.
No, Your Honor. They contemplated an agreement that is reflected in the words the parties used here.
Did they contemplate the program would be complete, the one that the contract undertook?
No, Your Honor, they didn't.
Oh.
What they did contemplate.
He's wrong then when he says they contemplated.
He is completely wrong, and it's not proper to use extrinsic evidence to contradict the express written terms of a fully integrated contract.
Well, I just wondered whether the contract itself contemplated.
The contract says, and I think this speaks exactly to the situation, was that if you look at page SA 19, the first the full beginning new paragraph there, it says, if ITA changes your responsibilities so that you are not primarily involved in 1U, maybe if we discontinue it, then we will together negotiate a new standard to substitute for Clause 1, which is the assessment period. Or, if such change is temporary, we may defer the assessment period for a period equal to that to which you were not working on IU or 1U. And so that says that if we change your duties, if we don't have 1U, if we have this kind of unexpected contingency, this is how we handle it. We together negotiate a new fair standard for compensating you at this company, which we both have to agree to. We don't just unilaterally say, oh, we're going to take all these options away from you and don't give you a chance to negotiate your position when you decide to discontinue the program or change the way things people intended to go forward. And the contract says, and to say that it didn't contemplate a situation where Mr. Levitin would leave prior to this assessment period or prior to the award of all the options or prior to some other event is completely inconsistent with the terms of the contract again, because it says, page SA 19, at the time of any termination, with or without cause, whether before or after the introductory period, all rights to unvested stock options will terminate and the disposition of all vested but unexercised options will be subject to the stock option plan. Okay? And the contract says that the options vest on a monthly basis. So they vest on a monthly basis and they're subject to a forfeiture event. And counsel takes exception to my characterization of this assessment period as a forfeiture event, but I just am borrowing from the, I'm just actually using the words of the contract, which say, in the event of any forfeiture. So if I've mischaracterized this notion of a forfeiture event based upon the contract saying, in the event of any forfeiture, I apologize. But it's a forfeiture event, and everybody knows vesting subject to forfeiture means what it says. And if the forfeiture event doesn't occur, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, it doesn't take a linguist to figure out that there is no forfeiture. And if the agreement says you're entitled to exercise the vested options on the date of your termination, which they chose the date of his termination, mind you, because they decided to discontinue his position. And now they're saying, well, they're creating some kind of extrinsic fantasy about what the CEO thought prior to the to rewrite the history prior to the entry of this agreement. I mean, I think this case is the more instructive case is the one that they cite with, which is the interim healthcare case. I mean, Judge Kaney, you were on both panels of Zielinski and the interim healthcare, where you say. Or where it's said by the author of the opinion, in so interpreting the language of a contract, we are giving the words their ordinary and natural meaning without questioning the logic of that meaning, which is appropriate in evaluating intrinsic ambiguity. Meaning, there is no intrinsic ambiguity in this case. It says vested subject to forfeiture. There's a whole series of things that could happen that would result in a forfeiture, whether it's the assessment period, whether it's they decide that he's not, Mr. Levitin is not doing his job, then the board can take options away. If they think he's doing a bad job, this agreement says that the board can meet and vote and say, Mr. Levitin, you're doing a terrible job in your job, and so we're going to take options away from you by a vote of the board. That's all it took, a vote of the board, and they could take options away. It's in the agreement. They didn't do that either. And they terminated him before all the – he was actually promised 200,000 options. But – he didn't get 200,000 options because they terminated his position prior to the entire time at which 200 options would vest. So they basically said, we're going to terminate you, we're going to cut our losses, we're going to stop the accrual of options, and then we're going to pay, and we're also going to forfeit all the options that we think. If they wanted to write this as a condition precedent, if they wanted to write the success of 1U as a condition precedent to the vesting of options, it would have been easy. Any lawyer could have drafted an agreement that provided for or structured this as a condition precedent. But everybody recognizes, even the affidavit submitted by their CEO in the summary judgment proceedings and the agreement itself states that this is the structure of this is a vesting subject to forfeiture. And everybody admits that's what this agreement provides. A structure, the concept of this, is the structure of a vesting subject to a forfeiture. And if a forfeiture event doesn't occur, it doesn't occur. That's not saying you're ignoring it. It's just saying it didn't happen. So the notion that we're going to go ahead and throw all this out, throw all the language out, we're going to stand this agreement on its head simply because they think it's not fair or it's not what the concept was or what they had in mind, it's irrelevant. What's relevant and what's important is what's in the agreement. And again, mind you, that this has a integration clause in it. At the very end, it says, this letter is intended to be an integrated agreement that supersedes all prior agreements, understandings, or negotiations. What they're doing is they're trying to have extrinsic evidence to introduce new evidence, new of negotiations or additional information about understandings that the parties had that aren't reflected in the written agreement. It's another thing you just don't do when you're interpreting a contract. And then this notion that the district court applied the wrong legal standard is, again, another red herring. The district court recited the proper legal standard. What the district court said was that, I mean, there is a case that says equally plausible is the standard, which I think is fairly read to be just another way to explain what the standard is. What is fair? What is a reasoning or a construction of a contract that's fair and reasonable? And they're saying
what it says is if you can think of two possibilities, then it's ambiguous.
No, the two that are reasonable. I mean, not one that's maybe a 5% chance versus an 80% chance. I mean, nothing's black and white, and nothing's completely.
So you think they have to be equally plausible?
No, I don't. What I'm saying is that it has to be ignoring vesting subject to option isn't even plausible. Okay, and I think that's what the district court said. And the district court said that.
You discussed conditions, and I always pronounce it conditions preceding. Isn't this discussion of also a condition subsequent?
I'm sorry?
The condition subsequent, which contract law discusses very clearly, only never mentions how you arrive at it. But
a condition subsequent would be as if there is I guess
an event which eliminates liability in the first place.
No one's ever argued that that's what this was, Your Honor. Well, I mean, what they argued is that this is vesting, and there's a reason that the shares have to vest.
But the condition subsequent would be a divesting of something which had already vested. And the contract can call for that, can't it?
Sure, but it sure could if you wrote that in there. Yeah. There's no way to read this in that way. The assessment period, when Mr. Levitin was terminated, the assessment period hadn't even ran yet. It hadn't even completed. And it hadn't even started yet. It hadn't even started yet. And for them to say that they discontinued this program, that's not what the record says. The record says that there's no challenge to the facts that this program didn't work, that the project didn't work, that they didn't get it to a point where it worked prior to the time they pulled the plug on it. But what they did, what the record says, is that they scaled back the project. And they maintained only the resources on the project that they needed to maintain their investment in it. And to even say that they discontinued it is kind of a play on words, because tomorrow they could decide to resurrect the whole program again and proceed with it. So, I mean, there's nothing permanent about anything that they say, but the facts that are undisputed is that the assessment period never even started, and even if it started on the date that it says in the contract, it had never even finished before Mr. Levitin left the company. And there's a specific provision of the agreement that says these options vest, and when you leave, for whatever reason, at any time after the 12-month period, you get to exercise the options that had been vested. And they never told him that there was a forfeiture. They never told him that they weren't going to do this. They never told him that they never negotiated with him, say, hey, we're not going to have one you anymore. What do you want to do? How can we work this out? None of that. And they're complaining. Their dilemma is something that they created themselves by failing to look at the contract, by failing to take advantage of other provisions in the contract that they provided, that they wrote into the contract in order to protect themselves in the situation that they're complaining the contract doesn't particularly address. If Your Honors have no further questions, I think we respond to all the points in our brief, and there was nothing additional in the reply brief that we had not addressed already in our appellee's brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. 2.5 minutes, Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Your Honors. Actually, I think if this argument has done anything, it's demonstrated this contract is ambiguous and cannot be interpreted as a matter of law by the district court. And for that reason, the case ought to be reversed and remanded. First, trying to address very quickly the points that were raised. I think, Your Honor, Judge Bauer, you have it exactly right, which is what we had here is a two-step process. There's a vesting of the options, and that wasn't something that was done sort of willy-nilly. That was something that was done so that the price of the options was determined at the time that he joined the company. If that it was done in another way, then the options would have to be priced at the subsequent market value of the shares. So it benefited Mr. Levitin to have the options deemed to vest, quote unquote, at the time that he joined the company, which was $10 per share, so that as he received the options over time, they would still be at $10 a share. Okay, but the fact that they were vested didn't mean that they couldn't be or wouldn't be forfeited in the future. In fact, the contract itself specifically states on the second page when talking about when options could, when if a forfeiture occurred, it says, in the event of any forfeiture of options, the options forfeited will be deducted equally from all installments, paren, including installments which have already vested, close paren. So the contract definitely contemplates that even though they're vested, there's going to be a subsequent reconciliation and potentially a forfeiture. But there's definitely going to be a reconciliation. There's going to be an assessment period. And that's the problem that we ran into in this circumstance, and that Mr. Levitin, with all due respect, is trying to take advantage of, is that this assessment period that's called for in the contract is not triggered because, contrary to the expectations of the parties, as reflected in the contract, 1U was put on the shelf, as opposed to being introduced to the market. And that's what the district court found.
Your opponent says that wasn't what was contemplated.
Well, Your Honor, that is what's contemplated, and that's what the district court found was contemplated. Noted on page 14 of the district court's decision.
They contemplated a failure.
No, I'm sorry. They didn't contemplate a failure, Your Honor. They contemplated two possibilities. It comes to market according to its current schedule, or it might be delayed, but it still comes to market. The contract doesn't contemplate failure. Because there's no...
There was a failure.
There was a failure. And that's what creates the gap. And my time is out, Your Honor. So thank you. The case should be remanded to the district court, reversed and remanded for further proceedings. Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And now...